get the call to order the meeting of State Government Finance Division. We do have a quorum. Representative Quam, did you get a chance to look at the minutes from the 27th?
I also reviewed and would move them.
Representative Quam moves the minutes from the meeting of February 27th, 2020. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. Representative Bernardi. And I'll move House File 2533 to be before us. And intention is to send this to the Ways and Means, yes. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's nice to see you this morning, and we had good weather coming in. I want to, again, thank you for taking up my bill. I do want to let you know that this bill did pass out of the House last year, and it did make it into conference committee, but it did not survive. And I just want to share with you about the bill, and the bill is provides for the appropriation from the general fund to the Legislative Coordinating Commission to support its work fulfilling an ongoing statutory requirement that the commission study matters relating to the economic status of women in Minnesota. This office had existed since 1976 and was basically defunded. You know, we can get into the details on that, but it no longer has a staff person, and work has not continued on the subject matter in that office. This is an important fact. This is very important. Women in our society make less on the dollar than what men do. They often are the caretakers of their children and their family. Over their careers, they often work less hours. And so things that impact their lives disproportionately compared to their male counterparts. So when we're paying for transportation, making 80 cents on the dollar of a man, our transportation costs are even more, and transportation costs are astounding. Even how we move about our day with transportation, it's not just the traditional model of the hub to the city to get a job. It's getting to daycare. It's getting to the doctor's appointments. It's getting to the grocery store. And that's just one example. And there's many more things that impact women, and including their social security, housing, and having this office is one way in which we can address this. It's one staff person. It's around $150,000 appropriation. And it leverages a lot of other resources in our state because it creates partnerships and it attracts interns in working on issues that impact women. And with that, I brought with me today Patty Tangi. She was the Minnesota Pay Equity Coalition, and I would like to have her share her remarks with the committee.
Well, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Nelson. My name is Patty Tangi. I am here representing the Pay Equity Coalition of Minnesota, which are basically a bunch of friends who got together and many, many years ago and decided we needed an office on the economic status of women. So I am here on behalf of Nina Rothschild, who was our commissioner on the Department of Employee Relations when this, shortly after this office was created. I'm here on behalf of Bonnie Watkins, who was our first state pay equity coordinator, and our second state pay equity coordinator is Faith Swemke. And also our first director on the Commission of, I think we called it the Commission on Women, is Aviva Breen. And so all of those voices are here with you today, and they represent a collective of four decades of work in this area. The Pay Equity Coalition obviously needs the data to go out into the world and do what we need to do to make sure women are paid what they're worth. So I represent that voice today. And this work of OESW is not only about pay, but it's also about women in sports and women and girls of color. It's about the voices of women around the state in the most remote places where people don't, from whom people don't hear from. And older women and women in the trades, and the list goes on and on. And unfortunately, we lost that voice in 2017 when funding was taken away from the office. So I just don't think we've reached a time in history where this important work is finished. We still don't see women at the highest levels of government. We still don't see women in the highest levels of business. And the work of the office would help collect that data and disseminate it to you and to other policymakers and the public in general, what we need to do about it. So surely it's not time to finish that work yet. And reviewing the economic conditions that affect women is important 40 years ago as it is today. So with that, I hope that you will continue funding the economic status of women office, and so this important work can continue to be done. Thank you.
And I have this Barbara Bastiste, said to be available to answer any questions if there are any. So members, do we have any questions of the author or the testifier? Quiet bunch this morning. I see there's an oral amendment, I guess, that has to be made to bring this into line with the current year and to fill in the dollar amounts that are here. And Mr. Gehring has that amendment if you want to read the oral amendment there.
Sure. Mr. Chair, so there are two components to the oral amendment. The first one is on line 1.7. What you'll do is delete everything before the word appropriated and insert $161,000 in fiscal year 2021 is. So then that sentence would say $161,000 in fiscal year 2021 is appropriated from the general fund. And the second component of the oral amendment is on line 1.9 after the period. Insert the base for the office is $156,000 in fiscal year 2022 and each year thereafter. So the effect of the amendment is to appropriate $161,000 in fiscal 21 and then establish a base of $156,000 after that.
Is that acceptable with the author of the bill?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
And members, is the any questions on amendment? Does everybody understand the amendment? Mm-hmm. I see a questioning look on Representative Hertas's face, but anyway, okay. Do you want to repeat that again, just so we know what we're voting on? And
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hertas,
thank you for asking to repeat it because Mr. Gehring speaks so softly, it's hard to hear.
That could explain the puzzled look on your face.
So, Mr. Chair, the oral amendment is on line 1.7, delete everything before the word appropriated and insert $161,000 in fiscal year 2021 is. And then on line 1.9, after the period, insert the base for the office is $156,000 in fiscal year 2022 and each year thereafter.
So, members, everybody understand the amendment? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is passed. Again, any further questions? Is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak on this bill, either for or against it? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2533, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Bill's referred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next bill we have on today is House File 3429, Representative Dean. It's the election administration bill. And members, let's try and keep our discussion to this bill. I know there were some issues yesterday with the election that some people may want to go after, but that's not anything to do with this bill. And so, members, we're going to try and keep our discussion to this. And we'll move forward from there, and we can have some discussion about that after the bill is done. Representative Dean, I'll move House File 3429. It's going to Ways and Means.
House File 3429. Yes,
you can go to Ways and Means.
Wait, no, wait a minute. Fiscal note. What
took the fiscal note? I believe the fiscal note was, yeah, I'll let. Ms. Roberts, fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, members, you have a fiscal note that notes on the bottom of page 2 that there are some programming costs of $3,400, and that the Secretary of State's office indicates that they will be able to absorb those costs.
That, as I said, it needs to go to Ways and Means. So I move the House File 3429 be referred to Ways and Means. Representative Dean, you want to explain your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There's also, there were some amendments out there, and as I look at the amendments, the A3 amendment has already been incorporated. And when I looked at the A1 relative to the bill, at least the document that was out there before us, I couldn't make sense of it. So maybe if Matt Gearing could look at that briefly, that would be great. But as I mentioned, I believe the A3 has been incorporated, and there's some question about the A1.
Chair Dean, are either of these your amendment or?
Yes.
They were, but you claim they were. You say that they were already passed.
I believe these were passed previously in Gov Operations.
Mr. Gary.
Mr. Chair, so yeah, both of these amendments were adopted in Gov Ops, and so they're reflected in the first engrossment, which you have in your packet.
So, Mr. Chair, I have no amendments.
So there are no amendments. So, Representative Dean, you want to?
I don't know. Does this committee have a 24-hour rule, Mr. Chair?
We do, but sometimes we're flexible with that under okay. circumstances. But these two are already there, and this was all posted long before it needed to be. You know, sure. There should be no problem with that. But Representative Dean, explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is what's often known as the administration's bill for the Office of Secretary of State. This is a bill that we've been working on for quite some time to try to implement some changes that would benefit the elections throughout the state of Minnesota, working with local counties and other individuals. And I know that through elections and through GovOp operations, we've made some changes that I believe were agreeable to everybody. So I think that this is an easy bill for you all to re-refer. But I'm sure that some of you folks would have some questions. Ms. Bonowitz is here from the Office of Secretary of State and can probably answer specific questions better than I might be able to.
Members, any questions?
I've already been told I don't get to ask questions today.
Representative Nash, I didn't tell you that, but Representative Quamp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a clarification, because you're changing resides or resided to maintained. That infers the possibility of multiple locations. You know, I know a lot of people that spend the cold parts of the year somewhere else, or for business they may be, you know, spend portions of a week in another state. Does this verbiage, what really effect does that have upon an interpretation of where a person could vote?
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I'll have Ms. Bonowitz address this. It's been discussed at previous committees, but we're more than happy to discuss it again.
Ms. Bonowitz, if you want to state your name for the record.
Chair, members, Sam Bonowitz with the Office of the Secretary of State. We updated this language to say maintains residence to add more clarity. For voting purposes, you can only maintain one residence. And that's actually defined in section 200.031, and there's 13 sets of criteria for how you would define where you maintain your residence. But I would defer to research. Yeah.
Mr. Gearing. Mr. Gearing. Mr. Gearing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coleman, I don't have anything to add to that. I could read the residency standards if you'd like, but.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was mainly curious because when we've done different pieces of legislation, a simple change of a word allows for a judge or the courts to have a new interpretation of the existing statute. And so you're basically reaffirming that all the definitions stayed the same. We're just calling it something different.
Ms. Bonowitz. I see you shaking your head, but Ms. Bonowitz, I need a verbal answer.
Chair, members, that's correct. This is just clarifying what is in statute and allowing. So right now when voters vote absentee, there's confusion about where they're residing versus where they maintain their residence. And where they maintain residence for voting purposes is defined within statute. So we want to make sure that we're being crystal clear about where they can and cannot vote.
Representative Guam.
Thank you. One other curiosity. It appears as if in this bill you are taking away the flexibility to starting at 10 o'clock for small cities, but allowing a 30-day notice for a township. And I know most townships tend to be fairly small, some larger. To me, that seems as if you're doing two separate things. From reviewing the summaries that staff had generated, I was just curious about the logic.
Ms. Bonowitz.
Chair, members, I believe you're talking about the language that requires any polling place opening later than 7 a.m. They're required to notify our office. And that's really just because if we get a call from a voter saying my polling place isn't open, we would like to know, did somebody sleep in? Or is this just a township that opens a little bit later and that's to be expected? We just want to be able to tell voters what's happening in the event that they have questions.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the logic. I was just... I thought you also took away that flexibility with small towns, but then did a clarification with townships. And I know there are some towns that are much smaller than many townships. So I was just curious. Thank you.
Respond. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author or to the Secretary of State, either one, on page 5, starting at 5.26 to 5.29, it talks about, I'll just read it, the instructions must indicate that the voter must provide a valid Minnesota driver's license or identification card number or the last four digits of a voter's social security number unless the voter does not have and has not been issued one of those numbers. Does that last sentence void out the rest? Does that mean you can go in and vote without or register with no identification?
Ms. Bonowitz.
Chair members, that's currently how it is in statute right now. This is just kind of like rewording it a little bit. You have the option of marking that you don't have any of those identification numbers right now.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Green.
And then just to clarify, as I think I know, but just to clarify, what happens then with that registration form at that point?
Ms. Bonowitz.
Chair members, that is when the county auditor follows up with the voter directly and make sure that they don't have any of those phone numbers. They'll usually check with their local license service to make sure that they don't have any of those numbers. And they may forward it to the county attorney for investigation if they believe that that voter is ineligible to vote or if they have any indication that that voter is ineligible to vote.
Representative Green.
And then is this kind of what causes the problems with the same day registration when people don't have identification and then the registration forms come back? Is this the cause of that?
Ms. Bonowitz.
Chair members, no, this is no different than if you were to register before election day. And same day voter registration goes through all the same checks and balances as it does prior to election day, going through the Social Security Index, death records, the court records, DPS, et cetera, as well as ERIC, which checks to see if they're registered in another state. So this, we still go through all the same checks and balances with same day voter registrations.
Well, one last question, Mr. Chair.
If you look in your packet, there is a letter from the county officers, election officers supporting the bill. So, but
right, that's fine. But then the question then is, at this point with same day registration, by the time they check out these registrations, the ballot's already been cast. Is that correct?
Ms. Bonowitz.
Chair members, that is correct.
Thank you.
Further questions? Quiet bunch this morning. Representative Dean, if you want to any final words, and I guess I have before you do, I have one question. How long has it been since we passed an election administration bill? I know we've had trouble getting these passed
through the other body in past years. So Ms. Bonowitz or Representative Dean?
Mr. Chair, the last time it passed both bodies and went forward to the governor was 2017.
Thank you. So Representative Dean, you want to wrap up? And
Thank you for your time this morning, and I guess we're getting another question.
I guess we got another question
Mr.
here. We woke somebody up. Well, Representative Nash.
It's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I mostly just wanted to say thanks for Representative Dean's work to make this a bipartisan or nonpartisan. I think we had a few animated discussions last year, and that we made this nonpartisan. And I had expressed a concern with one of the provisions that had been listed in the bill, I don't know, a couple stops ago, and it has been removed. So thank you for listening to my concern and the concern of our side of the aisle to get this bill to where it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. It's a testament that good ideas can come from anywhere.
So with that, members?
That was a compliment.
Okay. Is that sort of like saying even a blind squirrel can find a nut once in a while?
Not quite like that, Mr. Chair.
Anyway, with that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 3429 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill's referred. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
And members, Secretary of State's here, and if he wants to come down, I know there might be a few questions, and if we can be civil about this, and maybe you can explain what happened yesterday.
Sure.
I know we are in this committee, but anyway. Mr. Chair, or Mr. Secretary, thank you for coming. I understand there was a couple of glitches yesterday, yep. And I've seen some inflammatory language and some inflammatory tweets, and I know that happens when something doesn't go the way it's supposed to, but if you want to explain what happened. And
sure. So, members, thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. So, first, I want to say that overall, I think that yesterday, from an administrative standpoint, across the state was a real success. Huge turnout in both parties, not just the Democratic Party, but the Republican Party. Big turnout, and I think those who wanted a presidential primary, including many at this table, were right to say that it would swing the doors wide open for a lot more participation. Yesterday afternoon, I took a lot of time working with our teammates in the counties and cities and townships, reaching out to them. I couldn't call all 87 counties, but I called a good number of them to determine how things were going, not just with the glitch that went with our office, but generally speaking, were voters satisfied? Were the wait times low? Was the equipment working? Did voters understand the new rules for this process? And uniformly, all the counties said things were going really, really well. So I just want to put things in perspective. But to what happened yesterday? Full responsibility lies with me and no one else. I'm the head of the office, and to the extent anything goes wrong, that is on me, always, and that's always the way it should be. We have to have free elections, and we have to have fair elections, and they can't be tainted by any view anywhere or any hint or insinuation that anyone in our office is putting a thumb on the scale for any candidate, any cause, any political party, period. And those of you who know me, those of you who have served with me, know how deadly serious I take that mission in the office. It is job number one in many respects. People are entitled to their political views, but you got to leave that at the door in our office. And I think I have the record to prove that. But yesterday was an unfortunate episode. I just want to call it what it is. You know, for 17 minutes, which is 17 minutes too many, we had a redirected link on the website that directed people to a partisan website that had endorsed a candidate for president. It was unfortunate. It is unacceptable. It will never happen again. And I want to let you know what we've learned from it and what we've already instituted as a response to it. What we've learned is that sometimes even a good plan is really subject to faulty execution. We have an emergency elections plan. It is in writing. We have had it for a while. It is tested. It is distributed. It is expected that people know it, learn it, and live by it. And that plan has a specific page on exactly what happened yesterday. If the poll finder goes down for an extended period of time, then there is a specific website to which the public is supposed to be redirected. It is a Google-based website, a poll-finding website. It is a nonpartisan website, obviously. And it is a website, in fact, that we work up in the run-up to every election to stock with information so it can be good for Minnesota voters in case we need it. In fact, as of the Friday before the election, last Friday, we delivered the latest batch of data from Minnesota to that Google tool so that if we needed it as a backup, it would be as updated as possible. So we don't just pick a website and direct people to it. We work with them at Google to make sure Minnesota information is there. So that was the plan, and the plan was not executed by at least one individual. That's on me. It's not necessarily on the individual, although it showed a real lapse in judgment of that individual to not follow the plan, number one, and in not following the plan to choose this particular website. Let me just say for a second that this particular employee is a career civil servant. I have no idea what this person's politics are. I don't care. I don't ask in my office, and I don't know, and I don't care. This was not a political statement on his part or any part. It was a lapse in judgment. When you have something with progressive in the title, that ought to set off an alarm bell. There are all sorts of, you don't have to be a political genius to know that there are certain buzzwords in politics, and if the website has that title, you ought to maybe step back and think. To this employee's credit, he also was one of the people who helped solve the issue. He made the decision to green light putting this up as a redirect, but he also, several minutes later, said, wait a minute, this doesn't seem right. So I want to give him some credit as well. It's a mistake. It's a terrible mistake, but he also was part of the solution. So it was 17 minutes. That's 17 minutes too long, and that is on me. That is on me. And so here's what we're doing about it, because I'm sure you want to know that. It's all well and good to be contrite and apologize. It's another thing to make sure it never, ever happens again. So we've done two things just in less than 24 hours, and I'm sure there will be more. Number one, we've instituted a whitelisting program where we're going to save a space on our system where when we redirect someone to a website, either for emergency purpose or any other purpose, if we redirect on our website, which has 400-some pages to it, if we redirect on a website to any other website, it will physically be impossible to do so unless it's on the so-called whitelist, a pre-approved, pre-screened list of websites. Obviously, they will be rigorously nonpartisan without a hint of any partisan taint or bias of any kind. By the way, that goes for elections, that goes for our Safe at Home program, that goes office-wide, business services. Anytime we are redirecting anyone for any reason to an outside website, it will have to be on the whitelist or it simply will not be done. Second, we can no longer rely for something as sensitive on this as this on one set of eyeballs. So that will not happen anymore. It's like turning two keys on the nuclear codes. I don't want to be too grandiose here, but it's a fairly good analogy. It's going to take at least two people from now on, despite the whitelisting, to make that call and make that decision. And this particular person will not be among them. So those are the two things in the short term that we've learned and that we're doing and that we're instituting. You have my deep regret that that happened. Our election system is only as good as the legitimacy that it enjoys. And I take the responsibility very seriously, regardless of party, regardless of political leaning, that every Minnesotan, whether they agree with things I do or have the same political affiliation or not, can at least have a base understanding that the system is fair. So that's what we've learned. That's what we've done. I can assure you it will never, ever happen again. I regret those 17 minutes. I'm glad that it wasn't longer than 17 minutes. It's 17 minutes too many. But you have had my assurance that we are on it. We're not done. I'm not just going to here say that I've done everything I need to do. We're going to complete a full investigation. You can imagine that yesterday our number one priority was actually putting on an election and making sure that the tools were working and that the system was working, and they did, and it did. I think we put on, as a whole, we and our teammates, a really, really good election overall. So this is an ongoing inquiry. We're always looking to build a better mousetrap. We have many people, talented people around this table, who have been managers and are business owners and understand that it takes a team. But ultimately, the person at the top of the letterhead bears responsibility. I do. I accept it. And to the extent these kinds of errors happen, they are on me. So with that, I am happy to stand for your questions. And more than questions, your comments, criticisms, suggestions, anything. And I'll say what I've said in other contexts. You can either say them here, or I'm happy to take your comments offline, in meetings, in texts, in anything you got. So give it your best shot. I appreciate it, members. Thanks for your patience.
Well, thank you, Ms. Secretary Simon. Question I have, what caused the redirect in the first place? Why were right. people getting a spinning wheel, like I've heard, on the Secretary of State's web or a poll finder site?
Yeah, so why did it go down, you mean, originally?
Yeah, why did it go down originally?
Mr. Chair, so why did it go down? So we're looking into the precise reason. I can tell you there is no evidence as of this point that there was any hacking, any outside influence, anything like that. I say there's no evidence of. That doesn't mean that down the road, as we discovered in 2016, we might not discover that. But as of now, we're not seeing any evidence of that. It also, we do not think, was a load issue. Those of you in the know, and there are plenty in this committee who are, know it's not a question of we were unprepared for the flow or the volume. We do so-called load testing on all the servers for all the obvious reasons. You're going to see huge spikes and real stress and pressure on the system on election day, from the poll finder to tens of thousands of people pushing refresh at the same time as, let's face it, all of us did last night. Every time someone pushes refresh, that's another little mini stress on the system, and when it happens to the tunes of tens or hundreds of thousands. So we do the load testing, and the load testing went very well. So we don't think it's that either. We're trying to unravel whether it was a code quirk or something else. I will say that it was, once we discovered the problem, it was up pretty quickly with that 17-minute unfortunate gap, followed by a small gap where we put the right redirect website in there. So that piece of sort of forensic investigation is still ongoing. We should have answers shortly, I think.
Mr. Chair, or Mr. Secretary, it kind of reminds me, in a previous employer I had, and I joke with people and I say it's your fault, this person's fault, there was a mistake that was made that caused some consternation, and they wouldn't let us fix it till they found out whose fault it was. And they waited 2 weeks for us to do a half-hour fix on something because they wanted to blame somebody. And so we started joking that everybody will take a day on the calendar, and whatever goes wrong on that day, it's your fault. And then we can just not worry about that and go into fixing it. And it appears that you guys went and fixed it as soon as you found out there was a problem. I have questions here. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Secretary Simon. You mentioned in your delivery about some of the data and the turnout. How soon, and do you intend to publish actual precinct participation in each of the legislative districts? Is that data going to be made available?
Secretary Simon.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaus. I assume you mean actual turnout, who showed up in which political party. That's actually on our website as of this morning. So with almost 100% reporting, the numbers are quite high. And as I said, I'm really pleased with the turnout. I think those who wanted to move to a primary, reasoning that it would swing the doors wide open to a lot more participation. I'm particularly impressed, I have to say, with the Republican turnout in this sense. You know, 4 years ago, there was a spirited contest with President Trump and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, and turnout was about 109,000. Last night, it was something like 100, and last time I checked, it was 160, 170,000 with no contest, realistically, right? And that shows a real surge in interest and participation. And obviously, you saw the same story on the Democratic side. So those numbers, Representative, should be on there right now, as of right now.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary Simon, when you assumed office, I noticed that the first issue of the Blue Book issued while you were in office, the format changed a little bit. And I would like to formally ask you in this committee to return to the old format of providing the precinct data in each of the elections statewide, so that we have an easy, all-flowing, you know, document that you can compare data. And that's something that I enjoy looking at. That's usually in the back of the book. The format changed to just percentages of who captured what. I hope that you will return in future editions of the Blue Book and this upcoming election that you'll have that data back in there the way the format used to be. Not all websites are the same. You may be proud of your website, but I don't find it particularly friendly to navigate in all instances. And there's a couple other ones that we as elected officials navigate, like the Campaign Finance Board is also cumbersome to navigate their website. So sometimes it's just easy to grab the Blue Book when you want to compare some races or data. And I hope that you'll take my recommendation seriously and return to the old format of having all of that data in the book. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I've noticed that too with some websites, state websites. I think when they started trying to move them to be more compatible with the cell phones and smartphones, that some of those things kind of interact or counteract with each other, and sometimes it's a little difficult to get to the find the information you want. Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hertel, so yeah, that's an ongoing debate. We got a lot of feedback on the other side saying you don't need to clutter up the blue book with all this precinct by precinct analysis. And then the compromise that we reached, talking to a lot of people who came to us, was, well, we're still going to have that online. So you can go back many, many elections and find the granular precinct level data, but we'll have the more streamlined version in the blue book. We'll consider that. The next blue book won't come out until 2021. So it's pretty timely. It'll come out, you know, in the spring of next year. So I'd love to talk with you online about the feasibility for that.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I did find the data eventually on the website, but it would be nicer to be able to find that data without having to link to kind of make four actions to get to it. And, you know, especially post-election, it would be nice to just have kind of a dedicated tab where you can just bang, go right to it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Secretary, thank you for coming this morning. First, let me say well done on the precinct experience yesterday. Went to the polling place, and it went off without a hitch. So that was a good thing. This issue that we're talking about was not. And I am going to take you up on your offer to hash this out later, because I have a lot of questions. But I guess some of the first questions that I have are, when the conversation about a redirect came up, I'm sure it was, I think according to your testimony, it was weeks ago or perhaps months ago that, hey, we should have a redirect.
Yep.
And having the whitelisted or the agreed upon bipartisan or nonpartisan whitelist, were there sites that were on that list that had been preloaded, or had it never been done? It just was a talking point that we said, hey, we should have that, but it didn't get done.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, no, we didn't have the whitelisting policy that we are now going to implement. So it was in the guide, literally, physically written down. Here's what happens. If this happens, go to this website. So it still required a manual step for someone to put in a website. Obviously, that's not going to happen again. So now it will be whitelisted. There will be at least two pairs of eyes that will have to look at every such change, and will be on a preloaded list. And there will only be one option for that particular redirect. But, you know, we redirect to other websites in other contexts, business services, Safe at Home, et cetera. So this will be an office-wide policy.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Secretary, can you tell us, after having probably looked at the server log, how many redirects there were yesterday in that 17 minutes?
I can. Yes.
In Secretary Simon.
Yes, thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, yes. I thought you might ask that. There were 490 redirects. Now, that's not to say they all went there. My understanding is that's 490 people who, during that 17 minutes, went to the site and saw that link instead of our poll finder, because the poll finder was down. So 490, 490.
And Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. So during that time, the 490 people who went there, that site had some things that were activated on it that collect people's it will exchange cookies, so you have to have that going. It does take people's Facebook profiles. In order to get to the poll location of your choice, of your query, you had to fill out an email, right, and provide your personal information. Have you reached out to the PAC that was redirected to ask them to delete all information they got during that time, or are you going to do that? Because quite honestly, the people who were thrown there, let's say half of them were Republican. Well, they don't want to sign up for that. And perhaps the results of yesterday's DFL primary here in the state would also say that many people didn't want to be signed up for Elizabeth Warren's information either. But have you talked to them about deleting that or purging that information?
Yes. So,
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash. Yes. So, as part of coming up with that number, we are in the process of reaching out to them to see what can be done. Again, 490 isn't necessarily the number who went there. The number of people who went, as I understand it, to the website while that was the substitute link or the redirect link. I, of course, went to the site myself afterwards, after everything was up and running. I'd never heard of the site, frankly, or the group, to be honest. when I went there, I did see that, yeah, you have to enter your email address. I wouldn't do that. I would hope a lot of Minnesotans would be a little bit wary about that, but some might not. They might just think, oh, this is what you do in a poll finder, and I don't know, I've never heard of this group either. Okay, if I need to find my polling place, I'll put my email address. So your point is well taken, and we're going to try everything we can to see if we can narrow that gap and get more specific about who might have used it during that 17 minutes.
Okay. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and Mr. Secretary, I do hope that we can have the conversation about how to make these things better moving forward, because I will say, while you and I are in different parties and we disagree on a great many things, you have done a pretty good job over the time that I've interacted with you on a lot of things, but keeping the election interface to your webpage has been good, has not been partisan. This, as you know, made me go a little nutty yesterday, and I think rightly so. I went to the webpage, and I will let you know how much bold progressive stuff I get in my email. I might forward them on to you, but this is a breakdown. This is not how things should work, and I am a little disappointed that some of the things that you're talking about today weren't in place previously, and that if you had gone to the extent to say we are going to have these sites on a white list that we'll throw at it if we have a problem, to have that articulated but not actually up and running, I'm a little disappointed. Things happen, I get it, we do. You know, those of us that are in IT here understand that regardless of how well-intended you are and how much time you may put in, someone's gonna find a way to break something, and it's that due diligence to make sure that when it breaks, that something that is usable and workable as a backup is available. So I was very surprised that this even was a thing. So next, I guess I would ask the poll finder not working concerns me, and I'm wondering if that was perhaps a denial of service. Would really love to see what the traffic on that was. So for those that may not know what that is, it's a denial of service is overloading a feature or a function on a web page on purpose in order to make it not react in a timely manner. So while traditionally that we may not think, or there may not be evidence of an outside organization hitting that feature, I'd really encourage you to take a closer look at that and have some forensic analysis done of that, because if it doesn't work and you've never had this problem before, maybe that's a conversation that's worth having to see if appropriate resources were made available to handle the traffic, or if somebody was out there trying to fiddle with all of that. And then to the topic of change order, essentially change order management, making sure that this doesn't happen in the future. I will ask to see some of the things that come out as a result of this. And I'm sure Representative Elkins and many of the other folks, both in IT and not, we all are gonna get asked questions. I'm sure many of you were asked questions last night, and you thought to yourself, boy, I wish I had Nash's phone number for dial a nerd, but this should be something that all of us are able to comment on. And Mr. Secretary, I would ask that you, in your investigation, in your output of the investigation, that you come back and tell us, one, in greater detail, what did happen. And I don't want to assign motives, because here in the House, apparently we don't do motives, and I agree with that. But the question is, how did that particular site get chosen? That's going to be one of my big burning questions, is how on earth would somebody in your office pick a progressive web page to use as the redirect? So look forward to hearing again from you. I'm guessing that there are going to be a lot of other members who have questions and would like perhaps nauseating detail on what happened, and I will echo that. I think that this is a black eye, and it's not something that I would expect ever happen again. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Secretary Simon, you want to add? This is more of a comment on his part.
Sure. Well, Mr. Chair, I entertain any other questions now or privately, as I say. I'm happy to talk offline, meet offline, including with staff. But it's a great lesson, right, for any organization. You can have a great plan, but it's only as good as its execution, not just in a mass way, but in a micro way. And as I say, this is on me. Ultimate responsibility falls to me. And you can rest assured that we're already working to make sure this never happens again. So I thank you, and I look forward to future conversations about not only this particular episode, but how we can all continue to try to make the fairest election system possible.
And I have a few more people on the list here with questions.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Secretary.
Good morning.
Couple questions and then just maybe a comment in response to some of your statements. Representative Nash talked about the traffic during the primary. I'm just wondering if you'd be willing to comment in terms of the traffic itself during the primary as compared to the general election.
Secretary Syme.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, you're talking about the traffic
poll
in
finder.
Terms of the use. Mm-hmm. Oh, the poll finder. You know, not as great, obviously, huge. I mean, the general election, the November election, is the big event, clearly. And there's so much more stress on the system in a November election, typically, than there is yesterday. You know, we could get you those numbers in terms of the overall traffic. So I guess we could get you a comparison of that, but I can tell you, generally speaking, we haven't had a presidential primary, a real one, since 1956. So it's hard to have a baseline for what heavy traffic is on a presidential primary. But if you compare it to the other kinds of primary, the August primary, and certainly the general election, we can get you those numbers in terms of overall traffic.
Secretary Samuel, wasn't it 90? Didn't we have one in 92?
Mr. Chair, we did. I always like to say it's a little apples to oranges. It wasn't a binding primary. Turnout was dismally low for that reason. It didn't mean anything. It didn't allocate any delegates. It was just bragging rights, and people knew that, and the turnout showed it. So little apples
so
to oranges.
So
yeah.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary Simon, the reason I asked the question is because, if I can recall, even with the comparison between the traffic in 2016 versus today, it's troubling in the fact that that tab went down yesterday again after that tab went down in 2016 for the traffic flow that occurred during that occurrence. So we've had 4 years to kind of boost the robust nature of that tab. It's a concern to, I think, our side, or it should be for anyone that watches politics, that we haven't fixed that in 4 years. Another point, Secretary, recently, I think yesterday, the DFL party chair, Mr. Martin, insinuated in the press that foreign interference may have brought down the poll finder. This is not a gotcha question, but your office speaks to the nonpartisan impartial nature of elections. I'm just hoping that you might comment to him personally or to us in terms of the nature of that comment from a intrusion interference perspective that we've heard so much about in years past regarding elections.
Secretary Simon, and it's the first I've heard about it going down in 2016.
Yeah.
I don't, is that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, no, nothing like this happened in 2016. There are always some little glitches, but nothing happened like this where we had to go to a redirect. That hasn't happened, I don't think, for many, many years. Certainly it predates me. But in terms of any comments, whether it's by the person you mentioned or anyone else, no, we don't have any evidence at this point there was any outside interference by anyone, foreign or domestic, at this point. I say we don't have evidence of it. That doesn't mean that ultimately after a forensic investigation that couldn't come up. I want to make clear. But I want to tell you what the facts are, and we do not have evidence of that at this point.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, I think your response to the lapse in judgment by one of your employees is commendable. And I think we all share the same desire to make sure that our elections are without criticism. That being said, a couple points. A serious lapse in judgment by anyone in our employ certainly calls into question their ongoing not import or usefulness, but there should be consequences that are an outgrowth of that lapse in judgment. In any other environment, I would expect that that person would have a serious review, at the very least have something placed in the jacket, but I think more normally, I mean, call into question whether or not this rises to the level of maybe not termination, but some type of retraining, or even more important, you know, probation with regard to their actions. 17 minutes, although it is short in duration, certainly cause a number of people to be confused, and I think it's symptomatic of what might be possible. I appreciate the changes that you say are being put in place. But in a grander sense, Secretary, what I think we're all here really kind of grappling with is we are stewards of the public trust. That trust was broken yesterday, even if it was just for 17 minutes, by an individual, whether willfully or in a benign fashion, took it upon themselves to input information that had not been vetted by your office. I appreciate the fact that you're standing up and taking responsibility for it. I think it's our job as stewards of that public trust to make sure it never happens again and be vigilant about it. And I share Representative Nash and Representative Hertas and Representative Quam's concerns about the very nature of the lapse in judgment, trusting that it will never happen again. But I certainly will rely upon trust but verify motif in this. And actions do speak louder than words going forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of my questions, certainly all of them have been asked, and almost all of them have been answered by either the chair or Representative Nash. But I would like to second Representative Nash's suggestion that we really do need to look for evidence of a denial of service attack, because if it was and it worked, we're going to see another one in probably in August and again in November. We want to be prepared.
Secretary Simon. Yes.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary, you said something when you were first talking that jumped out at me when you said at least one employee. Do you suspect that maybe there's more involved in this to that also set up different sites?
Oh,
Secretary Simon.
No, Mr. Chair, no. Representative Green, no, I don't. I'm fairly confident at this point we're going to do an ongoing investigation that we know where sort of the pinch point was. And so, no, I think it was a question of someone making a bad decision. So, no, I don't have any evidence that anyone was scheming to put a particular website on there. In fact, to the contrary, I think it was an instance of someone seeing a tool down, wanting to be helpful. It was a mistake of expediency, a bad mistake, a lapse in judgment, but a mistake of expediency, not one of someone with a political agenda, someone choosing what looked to be a good poll finder to last in sort of a duct tape sort of situation, and that was it. So no, I have no evidence that this was beyond that.
Okay. Thank you for that. The other question that I have, and this maybe everybody else here knows this and I just don't, but why do you redirect outside of your office? That doesn't make sense to me, why you would open up someone who's going to the Secretary of State's office for specific information, and then they're redirected outside of that site. That seems dangerous and very unnecessary.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, it's for the public. Someone coming there not knowing where to go to vote needs to know where to go to vote. Now, we think our tool is superior. That's why we route people to our own internal tool. There are a lot of features to it that make it more accurate than the Google tool and other tools. But in a pinch, if you can't go with your best option, you got to provide voters, citizens who want to vote. They're on their way to work. They're getting kids off to school. They need to know now. You need that tool. So it's not the ideal situation, and that's why it's only part of an emergency operations plan, which we have. But sometimes you got to go with the less than ideal, and this is one example of that. It's for citizens. It's for voters in this particular case.
And Secretary Simon, you also said that on the business side of your office, you do that also for for information for people. Is that say to make it the citizens have be able to have the information they need to get?
Mr. Chair, that's right. We do it on occasion. I don't think it's widespread on our website. I'd have to do an account. We have 400 some pages on the website. If you go to every single possible page, I wouldn't call it common, but it does happen. And I think that's a common thing, both in government and sometimes in the private sector. So it's something we do. We do it sparingly, but only in a situation like this. It was literally in something called the emergency plan, and that's because it's a service that people use, and we don't want it to be interrupted. So if we can't go with our number one choice, at least a second choice is available to them. So that's our thinking.
Representative Green.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The rest of my questions have been answered, but the one thing that did really bother me is that for 490 people that were redirected, if this system can't handle this election, this primary election, where the turnout hopefully will be much better come November, if something can't be done, I would suspect we may have some more problems. And it's good to have the white list, but I don't know. I still don't understand why it seems good to you to direct people outside of the state site. It seems dangerous to have that information out there. And I too would be interested in knowing if this PAC is going to delete that information.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And several things I find disconcerting. One, after hearing that, you know, you're familiar with the websites, entities, and things, you're familiar with election activity, this being so obscure of a site that you weren't familiar with it, you know, whether you do Google or Bing to find a polling look, you know, just cursory glancing, I'm not finding this site pop up. So if it's not, you know, how did the person locate this site is the first question I would come up with, because if it's not in the top several pages of a Google or a Bing search, then it's not likely that they went, oh, we need another link, and did that. So obviously that was a site that was available to their personal knowledge. I would think that'd be a logical assumption. So, you know, frankly, I think you need to, you know, understand the resources that your personnel go to first when they're queried for a need, and have a list not just for these links, but make sure that the election personnel of the state of Minnesota have a reference to give and assist voters that has been appropriately vetted, so that, you know, we take care of this occasion or exposure, but we have other exposures. So systematically, that would be good. The other thing that's disconcerting is the order of magnitude for the traffic compared to multiple general elections and et cetera, unless you've done some sort of change to the system, I would be surprised that we have a susceptibility that hasn't been hit before. Either we didn't realize or something's changed. And so that should be part of your investigation. My understanding is that your office is not directly utilizing Minute for many functions, but there is some office support and et cetera. And I'd like clarification if you're using totally internal hardware, software, and systems, or you are utilizing some cooperative with Minute.
Mr. Secretary Simon, I believe you've testified in the past that you don't use Minute for anything but for email and other stuff like that, but I'll let you testify to that.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam. So we have an interesting relationship with Minute. We're not a Minute agency like all of the cabinet departments are. We're independent. We do all our own coding and all the rest in-house. We do use them for some things. We use them for email. We use them for some communications. But we are collaborating with them on election security. So there may be a role for Minute here. We'll see. Once we're done with the forensic analysis, there may be. I'm open to that.
Mr. Chair, is more specifically wondering if you're utilizing any hardware or software that Minute's involved with in conjunction with your website and these ancillary functions.
Secretary Simon.
The short but maybe incomplete answer is yes. We do utilize some things, some tools, at least indirectly aid us in our security efforts. Yes.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, I would hope that this is checked and whatever we do to prevent this or improve our protection from this, that we review what's happening in other agencies to make sure that this isn't going on regularly. You know, somebody puts in their own information for a redirect or, you know, that exposure is out there if in true there's cooperative with Minute, there might be susceptibilities from doing things the same way. Thank you.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, Secretary of State Simon, I received many compliments from on how smoothly it was to both vote on Election Day, but also early vote. To that end, I have gotten a couple of questions about early voting, and a number of constituents may have voted for candidates who have since dropped out and are hoping that there is a fix that we can do because they like voting. They like voting early at their convenience and having that ability. But I have gotten a couple of questions on Facebook and elsewhere from constituents about recalling ballots for candidates who have dropped out beyond that, I think, 7-day window or 5-day window. So that was the real question that I got. I also want to echo concerns from Representative Nash and Representative Elkins on hacking or meddling. But the real questions that I have gotten have been about some of that early voting and recalling ballots. Is that something that you think is a possible fix? I know it's difficult, especially my constituents all live in the city of Minneapolis, and I know the city of Minneapolis has really excellent early voting where they process ballots on site when you go to early voting. So I don't know if there's a fix there, but is that something that your office is looking into?
Secretary Simon.
Chair and Representative Jordan, so it would take a legislative fix. You all would have to pass a law to change that. And just to zoom out a little bit of a history of that law, it used to be, the cutoff period used to be 4 days before the election, but several years ago, before I was Secretary of State, the legislature acted to change it at the request of counties, cities, and townships because they needed more time, not less. There has to be some period mm-hmm. where there's a cutoff. It's now 7 days. In other states, it's longer. I think in some, it's shorter. The reason is when people vote absentee, they're not open and processed yet. They sit in a pile from day minus 46, because we have a 46 absentee day period. To day minus 7, they sit in a pile, unopened. And what you all have said is you can start opening them and processing them on day minus 7. That's why the clawback is day minus 7. If you made it the day before, you would have pitchforks and torches here at the Capitol. Just be prepared from county and city and township elections administrators, because I think they would think they're going to go crazy. So it's always this push and pull between a reasonable clawback period, which is basically the day that you tell them by law that they can start opening and processing those things. So that's your judgment call. We can have a deeper conversation about that, but that's where that clawback period comes from.
And Secretary Simon, we have the 7 days before the election, you actually, when you go in an absentee vote, you actually put your ballot in Correct. The machine. So someone that may have voted for Senator Klobuchar a week ago, it's already been counted and tabulated. It would be impossible to call some of that back. And so that, again, that's how some of our laws interact.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Secretary, Representative Jordan, any further questions? Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary, 2 points. One is I did try calling for a polling site yesterday morning, maybe around 9 o'clock for someone, and it took quite a bit of time to get the response. So is that because of an overload or operator problems?
And Secretary, what time did the thing go down that you had the problems? And
right, I'll have to look at the forensic evidence, but you know, sometime mid morning or so. And I think this was all resolved by, I think the number I remember, but I'll get you the numbers. It was something like by 10:48, I think, is the answer. But to your question about the phones, so for every election, whether it's the August primary, the November general, or now this election, we stand up a phone room, a call-in center, where we hire folks on a temporary basis to take calls. And as you might imagine, there's a big spike in the morning and there's a big spike in the afternoon, pre-work and post-work. So we had a lot of people. I visit the call center to thank them, see how they're doing. And it's just a question of higher traffic times at that time. We try to staff it leanly. We don't need, you know, as many people there as it takes during peak times during every hour. So we're cognizant of making it, you know, lean but efficient. And so it could just be that you called during one of the heaviest times and had a little bit more of a wait.
And then the second question has to do with the redirect. I know you've answered a lot of questions, but specifically the people that called during those 17 minutes, what were they, ordinarily would they have been redirected, or it's just the fact that there was something at that point, and where should it, they have been redirected to?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, so our plan called for redirection in the case of a service interruption away from our poll finder, where it's not available, to a nonpartisan Google-based site, the Voting Information Project, it's called. It's widely used across the country. So that's what should have happened, and that's what didn't happen. That was the lapse in judgment. That was the mistake. That is on me. But that's the short answer. And for 17 minutes, it went to the wrong place.
Thank
you. Representative Mason. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary Simon, as this discussion has been going on, raised one more question for me. So in your description of the events and things that did happen, I got the impression that there probably are no sanctions being taken against the individual for this lapse, call it whatever you want to call it. But I guess my question is, as we have this office, which is supposed to be nonpartisan, even though we find the people who lead it run in a partisan campaign to win that seat, it is kind of the holy grail that you need to protect the sanctity of the office. And as you prepare for the big game, the general election this fall, and you talked about establishing a white paper and, you know, having an approved list with regard to redirects, as a policy in your office, are there employee sanctions that your office can take? Is it written as policy? Are there fines or penalties for breaching the trust of Minnesota voters? And is it in statute or not? Do you think it should be?
Secretary Simon, and I guess some of that stuff which we're talking about here, sanctioning employees, discipline, is protected by law, and sort of like HIPAA laws where you can't disclose medical stuff, and there is things in law that we can't disclose, discipline of employees. But Secretary Simon.
Right. Well put, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas. Yeah, there are a number of options that we're exploring. So no, I don't want to leave you with the impression that nothing is going to happen and no discipline will be taken or no responsibilities will be changed. That's not true. If I conveyed that, then that's not true, or I misspoke. So we're evaluating our options. This is a classified employee. So with that comes certain rules, of course, and that is done through the collective bargaining agreement. So I don't think it's necessarily in statute, but it's by agreement. So we will have to work within that process.
Representative Hertas.
So the second part of my question, collective bargaining agreement or not, do you think that it would aid the integrity of your office and that elections are carried out fairly, that there were fines or penalties or direct sanctions for people in the Office of Secretary of State? Do you think that should be part of statute?
Secretary Simon, and I believe that would be infringing on collective bargaining rights and with Secretary Simon.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertaus, I don't think there's any reason to statutorily override what employers and employees bargain for in contracts with themselves. So I think we're well served by rules that at least in our office have served us well when there are disciplinary issues, and I see no reason right now, I have no authority right now to depart from those.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it seems odd to me that collective bargaining rights would take precedence over voter integrity. So I'm confused by that. I appreciate, you know, everybody wanting to have security in their job or employment, but this is a unique office, and, you know, to give the transparency and the confidence of the voters that there's nothing going on, I just kind of found that it may be true what the chair and what you're saying, but I think it's a conundrum that should be talked about.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, I do have to take issue with what I would call a false choice. It is not a choice between election integrity and collective bargaining. The collective bargaining process and the procedures in place do allow us to fully continue to serve the mission of election integrity. So I see that as a false choice. It is not a choice between, on the one hand, having election integrity, and on the other hand, accepting the processes that employers and employees have bargained for. I don't see it that way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Secretary Simon, thank you for coming. Thank you for volunteering to come and talk about this. I know we're still in the midst of trying to find out what's going on, but thank you for coming and informing us and keeping us apprised. And members, I kind of look at this like you have a car, and I'm glad nobody here has ever had a flat tire, never had anything go wrong with their car,
right.
Battery go dead. This is the type of thing that when humans get involved in stuff, mistakes are made. I mean, we're humans. And so hopefully we can come to the get to the bottom of what caused the delay and the service delay and go forward that way. Hopefully that this doesn't happen ever again, and it looks like you're trying to put things in place to make that happen.
And Mr. Chair, I would just say my offer stands. I'm happy to talk offline with any legislator or staff about this, share information, and so forth. I just want to put things in perspective. Yesterday was a very good day in terms of elections in Minnesota. Overall, the counties, our partners, our teammates at the counties, cities, and townships did an extraordinary job under challenging circumstances to put on a really, really good, high-quality election with a lot of integrity. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, thank you for coming. And members, with that, we're adjourned.